This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Ya. Well, my pleasure to be with you here this evening. We have actually Kirk from the Netherlands of the third world country known as California. You're here. The hurricanes have died down. The rains have died down. You don't need an ark in the middle of the alleged drought. That is taking place
it.
There. 50 feet of snow on the snowpack, and we have Dee with us, who partnered with me last week to do a Q&A show where the initial response was from our regular listeners. Please do more of that. That's really fun, and so we are going to do more of it again this evening, get through the questions we didn't answer last week. And then we had a number that said, hasta luego, we're out of here. We don't like what you had to say about Dode and Jonathan, so you're a creep. Goodbye. That's kind of a summary. You wrote a three-page response, and they had a lot more to say. But we can deal with that also later as well. There are some items in the news that we really do need to talk about. The first is that the progressives, the liberals in Israel, are embarking on civil war. They are doing everything in their power to divide Israel to the point of absolute anarchy and chaos over judicial reform. And it is tragic what we're witnessing. The liberal progressives, who I don't think have five brain cells that are functioning, are of the belief that judicial reform will destroy democracy and the economy, which is absolutely absurd. And I think we need to talk about it because we care deeply about Israel, and the present state of affairs is disgusting. The liberals went so far as to try to undermine the state of Israel with the European countries, telling Britain and Germany and others that they shouldn't even meet with Netanyahu because he is pursuing judicial reform. There's a reason that Israel needs judicial reform. The judiciary in Israel, the Supreme Court and the Attorney General, are an absolute woke mess. They're comprised mostly of Ashkenazi Jews, almost all secular, exclusively liberal. And they are self-perpetuating. You know, in the United States, you have a Supreme Court that is a decided number. It happens to be nine, an odd number, so it's pretty easy for them to decide, when a majority prevails. In Israel, I think it's 20-some-odd. But the 20-some-odd is really not a real number because the Attorney General can determine how many hear any particular case. They can have as few as three hear a case. So the Attorney General can pick the three that are most likely to give the verdict that he or she wants on any particular case, which is just asinine. But it's a committee that is part of this cabal of liberals that decides who gets to serve on this court. In the United States, to be a member of the Supreme Court justice, you have to be nominated by the person who won the most votes as president of the United States, and then you have to be affirmed by the Senate. There is no such thing in Israel. It's just a group of people that are not under any legislative branch. Nobody ever votes for the committee that elects them, and no one votes to oversee them. They have no democracy associated with them at all. And so to say that you need no judicial reform, it needs to stay the way it is to save democracy, is asinine. And so we do have, Israel does have a problem. Israel's other problem is it doesn't have a constitution. So the Supreme Court has no basis to render any decision other than that's my opinion. And as it turns out, because there's no basis for any decision other than that's my opinion, that's what I want, the Attorney General is actually the most powerful person in Israel because they can overturn any law, any edict, anything based upon nothing other than their opinion. So Israel has to have judicial reform, and Israel also needs a constitution. So that's my view on all of this, and I'm just disgusted by the lengths that the liberals have gone to try to destroy Israel. It's like the liberals lost the last election handedly. They can't handle the fact that they lost, and now they're playing self-righteous by being disruptive and taking the country to the point that it is a laughingstock in the world and is self-disintegrating. You have enough enemies. You don't need to be destroying yourselves. Next item in the news. And by the way, I'm not a Netanyahu fan. I'm most certainly opposed to his coalition. I think he has a bunch of nutcases in his coalition. I wouldn't trust any of them. I'd count my fingers after a handshake with any of them. I think that putting together a coalition that includes the Haredim, the religious parties, is asinine. But I will say that this coalition is much more unified. I mean, eminently more unified than the last one that included liberals, conservatives, and the Muslim Ram Party. But the religious are exceedingly counterproductive to the well-being of Israel. The United States has two enormous problems at the moment, and it doesn't seem to have a plan for either one of the two. We have said for some time that America is going to have a complete and utter collapse financially, that America's currency is going to collapse, our economy is going to collapse. It's going to be a far worse collapse than 1929, and there will be no recovery from it. What will ultimately happen is the Great Reset, where a replacement currency will be offered, debts will be forgiven, and you will be an all electronic currency where the government can control everything in terms of who has money and who does not. In the midst of this, we have been warning that BRIC, which is a consortium initially of Brazil, B, Russia, for the R, I for India, C for China, was about ready to drive the international economic bus, and that their first maneuver would be to get enough countries together where they could bypass SWIFT, which is the clearing corporation for international trade, and they would bypass petrodollars, being the case with OPEC and particularly with Saudi Arabia. So what did China do last week? They initiated a diplomacy between the two most formidable OPEC members, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And by doing that, and by them being the orchestrators of it, and China already being Saudi Arabia's largest customer, and China being second only to Russia in terms of their relationship with Iran, it put the United States in great peril. And this administration doesn't seem to know it and is clapping their hands and saying, wonderful, it's the numbskull that is our press secretary is just saying, oh, we embrace it because it speaks of stability in the Middle East. No, it speaks of the collapse of the U.S. economy. And there's nothing America can do about it. Now, all the while, we've had two California banks, one of which is a international bank having branches around the world, collapse with the Federal Reserve saying, we're not doing squat about it. Too bad for you. And this particular bank, in particular the Silicon Valley Bank, I mean, it was so woke, they went broke. They had the most liberal retards on that board and were so interested in social engineering, they forgot the rules of banking. This is a bank that I think gave almost $50 million to Black Lives Matter. They're so woke, they went broke. And crypto crippled them. They are so in love with crypto because of all of the fake money that crypto put into the bank and because so many of their favorite politicians, and these were a lot of politicians on this particular bank, were financed by the large crypto companies, which is nothing but snake oil. And so the crypto began to crumble. The bank's woke policies had no economic viability. The bank had no liquidity. There was a run on the bank. It collapsed. And there was no buyout and no Federal Reserve to step in and help them. Now, immediately after that, the next step of the equation is that Credit Suisse, which is one of the most formidable banks in the world, I lost about a half of its share value in the course of a day, and it was very close to having a run on it where it would have a liquidity crisis and collapse. Now, this is one of the most respected international banks in the world. If Credit Suisse fails, you are going to have an avalanche of bank failures. So what does the world players do? They decide, well, we'll have Switzerland invest $50 billion into Credit Suisse. Well, that means that they have now pretend money for their liquidity and that the government of Switzerland has gone all in on a bad deal. Now, that puts the entire country at risk. And so what's next? So Signature Bank was the answer, was next. And so now the plan is, because these things are falling like dominoes, that we'd go back to the 1980s and we would return to the strategy of having barely healthy banks acquire really sick banks to turn the almost healthy banks into sick banks. That's what we did to solve that problem. We have Bank of America now, which, by the way, doesn't exist. Bank of America was bought by or absorbed into Nations Bank. And Nations Bank just liked the name Bank of America better, so it created the illusion that Bank of America still exists, but it doesn't. But nonetheless, the old Nations Bank, now called Bank of America, was told to buy Signature Bank so that it does not collapse. But with the money that we've squandered, with the stupid reaction to COVID and shutting businesses down, trying to govern the economy as the politicians knew what they were doing, and then this budget by Biden where he wants to double capital gains rate. I mean, it's guaranteed that will destroy the economy.
Nobody bets.
Where Nobody he wants to double the tax rates on wealthy individuals, as if paying their fair share is going to bring prosperity, as if poor people started businesses or funded businesses. It is just utterly asinine. And all the while, he wants to take defense spending, along with our spying apparatus, to well over $1 trillion a year. Guaranteed collapse. Now, along these lines, you have Z going back to Russia. He's going to be there, I think, on Monday. He is the president's premier of China. And he's already had discussions with Russia about taking sides in that war. That is a war that, well, Russia or China will give lip service to. Well, you guys should negotiate some kind of a political statement. That is a war that does China enormous good, because what it does is it destroys America. America is literally creating its own grave by having forced Russia into the Ukraine and then spending hundreds of billions of dollars arming the Ukraine, creating these killing fields. And then with all the financial sanctions against Russia and everybody associated with Russia, we've shown ourselves to be somebody who can't be trusted. And so it is exacerbating the trend toward the BRIC alternative on the reserve currency, which would destroy America's ability to fund its debt, which brings the whole house of cards down. Now, in the midst of all this, the United States, because we like to pin the tail on a donkey, we want it to be, and you read anything in the United States, it's Putin's war. It's no more Putin's war than a man on the moon. This is a war that was conceived by George W. Bush and advanced by Lindsey Graham and John McCain and by the Obama administration and then by the Obama befuddlers. And what we're trying to do here is to say this is Putin's war, so we now have The Hague going to issue an arrest warrant for Putin as a war criminal for some act some children allegedly were brought into Russia. No one knows if it's true. No one. I mean, the first casualty of this war was the truth, and the biggest propaganda agency happened to be in the United States. So we haven't a clue what's true in this war. You almost have to be careful not to make a statement. Matter of fact, the news out of the Ukraine this week is that one of the best commanders that the Ukraine has had came out and said, listen, this is not going the way that it's being reported. I had 500 men assigned to me, and all 500 are either dead or wounded to the point that they can't engage anymore. And so they're sending new recruits to me that are unwilling to even fire the gun. And you say, why won't you shoot? I don't like the sound of it. Why won't you throw a grenade? I'm afraid of it. Said they have no training. Hey, what am I going to do? Leave them in a battle to just sit there and die?
Or just be slaughtered.
The Ukraine does not want to report their own casualties. So he was dismissed as a commander, not because of incompetence, but because he was honest.
Right.
Exceedingly sad situation. And it's a wonder, I mean, it's a curiosity. What is Z going to do relative to his visit with Russia? Is he going to supply them with weapons? Is he going to counter the U.S.? Because the longer this war goes on, the better it is for China, because their only competitor in terms of world power has been the United States and its league with Europe, and the United States and Europe are destroying themselves over this war. So it is in his interest that it continues, but he doesn't want to completely bankrupt the United States with his deal with Iran and with Saudi Arabia, and now with Russia. He could easily pull the carpet under the petrodollar and bankrupt the United States. But will he do so? Yeah, will he do so when the United States is still his largest customer? You know, will he invade Taiwan when he has no real reason to do so? He already has too much land, not too little land. He has too many people, not too few people. He has nothing to gain to invade Taiwan except ego. is he willing to risk the lives of what, you know, could be several hundred thousand Chinese soldiers for the ego points of integrating and dominating Taiwan? It wouldn't make sense rationally. So what is his game? And how is he going to play his cards? It's very interesting. So the world all around us falling apart in Israel, which we care deeply about, falling apart in America, which unfortunately we live, and its economy is in dire peril, and it has become the ultimate belligerent in the world, and it's we're actually have our future now in the hands of despots, the despots of Iran, Saudi Arabia, China, and Russia hold the cards in terms of the future of the United States. They could end the U.S. economy collectively in 15 minutes. That's not a good position to be in. So that's my review of the news. It's not a good time, and we know where it's headed. It's headed to a global catastrophe, particularly on Israel. We're nearing the time of Jacob's troubles. There's only 10 years between now and the time that Yahweh returns. The last 3.5 of it are going to be miserable for Israel. How things wind down over the next 3 years is not specified, but you don't typically expect a cataclysmic collapse. You normally witness steps along the way. Those steps are accelerating. Happening more in a more pronounced and more dramatic way than you would have anticipated for a global calamity starting in 2029 and into 2030. Anything you want to add to the that recap of the news?
No, I was curious. Is so much of China is built on selling stuff to us? Is there somebody they can sell enough of that stuff to? You know, to keep their economy going afterwards, but it may be superfluous. I mean, they don't care.
Yeah, it's a funny thing for me. I just have my one of my pastimes, like it is yours, Kirk, is golf. So I have watched live golf with considerable interest because everybody that I actually enjoy, because sports is a distraction, and we have to have distractions in life. Otherwise, you'd go absolutely crazy. So the sports is a distraction. My favorite sport to watch is golf. I have given up on the PGA Tour. I don't watch any events on the PGA Tour. I actually watch live golf. You might say, how can you do that, knowing that it's funded by the Saudi Arabians, who are responsible for so much bad stuff? Yeah, they killed a journalist. Well, the United States kills far more people. But, you know, I always respond to saying the same thing. So are you more upset that Saudi Arabia is taking their money and spending it on golfers? Or are you more upset the United States is sending them $100 billion worth of weapons and is enriching them beyond belief and is doing everything, selling out the future of our nation just to keep them on the petrodollar by promising to defend them against all foes? I mean, where is your concern? Ascending hundreds of billions of dollars to them and hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons and begging them for all manner of support, or is it on them spending $1 billion on golfers? And do you know that if you really torque them off and they say, I don't need you anymore, I don't want you anymore, you're an irritant, and they say, we're going to accept other currencies other than the dollar to buy oil, that our economy is over, that you have no more, for example, PGA Tour, because you have no sponsors?
Yeah.
I mean, can you think it through? This is the situation we're in.
Well, I thought it rather hypocritical. Let me just say one other thing. No one's brought this up. It's how hypocritical the guys from the European Tour who play in America, and at the end of every year, they go over for their big event not in Saudi Arabia, but in the Middle East, and deal with the same Muslims. They don't seem taking their money is no big deal.
Well, the European Tour, Yeah, the European Tour has no issue against LIV Golf, other than the PGA Tour has responded improperly all the way
along,
and has co-opted everybody in terms of every sponsor and the media, and now the European Tour saying, no, can't allow them to integrate and play with us. So that's the only reason that they're opposed to it. Otherwise, it's pure hypocrisy. Aramco is a significant funder of all the tours. Aramco is Saudi Arabia. So,
sure.
It's silly. All right, Kirk, we're going to return to Q&A. I'm going to see if I can upset more people. You know, I guess a little bit of an overview is important.
Okay, please.
I spent the last show sharing my conclusions on and insights into the questions being asked. And what I did is, rather than saying I'm dictatorial and this is the answer with no explanation, what I said is, you know, that's an interesting question. You can look at it from the following perspective. These are how I have gone about trying to understand this. This is where I think the information leads, and try to use it as a teaching experience so that those who are listening would be better equipped to make their own decisions. Because I think if you do that, if you equip people to make their own information as opposed to you just tell them the answer, they're far better off. Everybody's better.
Agreed.
And so that was the approach that we took. And one of the things that pretty much everybody knows about me is that I'm going to go where the words lead. That's just what I'm going to do. And if you push back and then try to demean me or undermine my credibility, which I only care about because of the breadth of work at Yada Yada, and that there is no other replacement for it anywhere in the world, so I care deeply about it for those reasons, then I'm going to double down on you. I'm not going to back away. I'm just going to double down on you. And that's what will happen in this particular case for those that have got themselves all in a twit over the discussion what was really going on between Joe Dode and Jonathan. And in that case, they lost sight of the big picture. The big picture in that story is magnificent. You know, what you had is a story that is so essential for the next 10 years. Israel and Iowa are going to trauma bond. Trauma bonding is an exceedingly effective way to bring people together. Jonathan and Doe, David, trauma bonded. And while it's not always good, if you're trauma bonding with the right person, it is a spectacular result. If people go through a difficult experience together, then you know that you can trust that person.
Right.
And you know, of all the stories that are told in the Torah and Prophets, one of the really wonderful people is Jonathan. Damn, if I had been around, I might have fallen in love with the guy too. He risked it all to do the right thing for someone he cared about.
Right.
He's a man of character. He's a man with courage. He was bright. He was articulate. He was outspoken. He cared deeply about Yahweh. He knew him, respected him. He's a good man. Now, he's an attractive sort of a guy and the right sort of a guy to trauma bond with. And it's not just that that story is so essential for what's going to happen to Jews over the next 10 years. The world as a whole is going to go through tremendous trauma, but nothing compared to what's going to happen to Jews. This is Satan's last gasp. He can't win with a majority vote. Yeah, he's going to get the vast majority of Jews. He's going to get all the progressives, and he can have them. He's going to get all the Haredim, and he can have them. He's going to win at least 80%. And of those who it is even possible for them to be open-minded enough to want to get to know Yahweh, except that Yahweh has a name and that it's important, that there are five conditions of the covenant and five benefits, and those conditions are fulfilled through the Moed Mikre, and that we can tell that Yahweh is coming back on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, October 2nd, 2033, that because of those things that are so inconsistent with Jewish culture, Jewish society, Jewish religion, that it's probably in the range of 5% at the most of the 20%. We're dealing with 1% of Jews worldwide who will even be receptive. And that's 70,000 out of 7 million, or, you know, 14,000 out of 14 million. It's not a lot. And that's just the ones where it's even possible that Yahweh's message is going to resonate. And so we're going to continue to focus on those individuals because, well, Yahweh is not running a popularity contest and is looking for qualities that were reflected in Jonathan, qualities that were reflected in Dode. There isn't another voice out there or series of books out there conveying Yahweh's written testimony to us, translating it in an amplified, accurate, and complete fashion, and then sharing commentary and insights on what it means to our lives today, and particularly the lives of God's people. And so that is the mission that we're on. We want Yahweh to be pleased when he returns on Yom Kippurim, that the quality of the people that join him is pleasing to him.
Here, here.
That's what we're about. And nothing anybody says or does is going to stand in the way of that. You know,
nope.
you want to leave? You want to disparage me?
Go.
The door's open.
Yep.
Go. Be careful, though, because there's been a lot said about what we're doing.
Right.
And there isn't anybody else doing it. And my guess is that 99% of what you've come to know about God, you've learned here.
I would have to agree with that, for sure.
So be careful. Just, you know, if you want to go, go quietly. That would be my advice. Don't go trying to kick dirt in our faces. But, you know, it's free world. You can do what you want. All right. So with that said, go ahead, Dee. I know we only got through about half the questions last week. Let's see if we can stir up some more dust.
All right. This is from Mary P. She says, hello, I have a question. At some point, probably more than once, I think Craig mentioned that covenant members get to go home on Teruah a few years ahead of Yahweh's return, before the worst of Jacob's troubles. She would like the passages where this could be found.
Okay. Initially, you're drawn to this idea of what the Christian would call the rapture because of what's in the Christian New Testament. And then you very quickly learn, if you're open-minded, that Paul's testimony on it in Thessalonians is where he talks about it. And he actually says, we who are alive will be drawn up first, and then the blink of an eye, other people. And he calls it a rapture, which is a violent snatching away.
Wolf-like.
He was wrong.
Yeah.
He was wrong. Mm-hmm. False prophecy. Prove that he was not speaking for Yahweh. All right. So you have to now discard everything that Paul had to say. He proved that he's a false prophet. So then you turn, you know, the next thing you talk about and that the that permeates our society in terms of an awareness, because this is something that's not talked about at all in Judaism. not talked at all about in Islam, only talked about in Christianity, and the second source would be Revelation. And there it says, you know, you're going to be kept out. The you know, it goes through the various church ages and it's ending with Laodicea and says that, you know, you're I'm knocking at the door, you don't hear me, so you know, boo-hoo for you. And it speaks of them being kept out of this time. But the problem is, the number one text upon which Revelation is based is Ezekiel. It's not that Ezekiel failed the test of a prophet. To fail the test of a prophet, you get one statement that's historically inaccurate, one statement that is prophetically inaccurate, and yeah, you have failed. You are not a prophet, and you are worse than death. Ezekiel didn't get any statement regarding history correct. He didn't get his own current events correct, and he got nothing about the future correct. He is an absolute zero, and almost everything he says is diametrically opposed to God. So
right,
the very fact that it cites Ezekiel, talks about the Magog War, for example, there is no Gog. There is no Magog. There will be no Magog War. It's all a pile of rubbish. So Revelation is not trustworthy. Oop. Okay. So her question was, maybe I should apologize, because here there wasn't really a quick answer to her question, and rather than giving the quick answer, I'm giving a whole story here. So
okay.
I hope you all enjoy the
no,
story.
No. Go.
I enjoy the history. How do you come to these things? All right. The most interesting proof text for the rapture is this, not rapture, but the harvest of saved souls on Teruah,
mm-hmm,
is through Yahweh's own discussion of Teruah through his prophets. But I personally think that Yeshayah, Isaiah 17 is probably my favorite, because it sets text
yes
of time. It gives you a scale of the number of individuals. It's discussed in a lot of places, but let me share with you, because it's Yeshayah 17, towards the beginning of the chapter, and I'll share my thoughts. It says, the children of Yisrael, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of messengers and envoys. And it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Yaakov, Israel, will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable. And the fattest, best protected, most important midsection of Israel's body shall be leaned, shrinking in size. Well, the United States and the Supreme Court of Israel collectively forced some 20,000 Israeli settlers out of northern Gaza, made them give up their homes, their farms, their businesses, and retreat. And so the western part of Israel at its midsection is already thinned. I think it's about 10 miles wide at this point. And the United States and Europe, and of course the Islamic countries, are pushing very hard for a two-state final solution, where the what's called the West Bank, which was under the control of Jordan, is given to the Palestinians. And if that occurs, Israel is exactly this. So if the world forces Israel into this, then Israel will be narrowed at the midsection, where country is no longer viable. I mean, if you look at what happened, what was the consequence of the United States and the Supreme Court of Israel collectively deciding that Israel should abandon Gaza and allow allow Hamas to control Gaza?
Mm-hmm.
Unmitigated hell for the people in Gaza.
Oh, yeah.
They were rather than being the great victors, liberated, free at last, no. They live a hellish life. Hamas is a disgusting, reprehensible organization in terms of the treatment of its own people. And in addition to that, Israel is pummeled regularly with Hamas terrorists and Hamas rockets, and it's only going to get worse. So the world played that game, and it failed miserably. So what does the world want to do? Play the same game. We'll just play it on the other side of Israel. And this notion that, well, that's controlled by the Palestinian Authority, and they're better. No, they're not. And by the way, if there was, if that was separated from Israel today and the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, it would be controlled by Hamas in 15 minutes. They're vastly more popular. Mm-hmm. The only reason it's not controlled by Hamas at this moment is the IDF precludes that from happening. But if it was given to the Fakistinians, it would instantly be controlled by Hamas, and Israel would be in a pincher, narrowed at the waist, and totally and completely indefensible. That's what this is talking about. And it's going to occur sometime over the next four to 5 years. And it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest. So at the time that Israel is shrunk in size, then there will be a gathering in and receiving of a harvest, reaping the grain from the chaff, grain are saved souls, chaff are worthless souls, in season, in the proper time, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby establishing and validating the standing grain. And with his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and the ability to shoulder burdens, and his visible appearance as light, he will be collecting and harvesting the first fruits. And it shall be a gleaning, a smaller secondary harvest of ears of grain in the valley of Raphaim, in the midst of souls destined to die. Then in him, in Jacob, Yisrael, and the covenant will be those who leave, gleanings, smaller secondary harvests, as in going around and encompassing and shaking off as a means of harvesting an olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top uppermost branch, four or five on the fruitful branches which are separated, prophetically declares Yahweh, God of Yisrael. When he talks about two or three, I think he's speaking of 2,000 or 3,000. When he speaks of 4 or 5, mm-hmm. I think that's 4,000 or 5,000. I think collectively, if you take the midpoint of these things, I think he's talking about 7,000 or 8,000 people.
Yeah,
and I
good
think,
number.
Could be collectively among all Yisraelites. It could be collectively between Yisraelites and Goyim. Mm-hmm. The 2,000 to 3,000 could be Yehuda, and the 4,000 to 5,000 could be Yisrael, and the difference of one tribe versus those mm-hmm. from the other 11. Those are all possibilities. It does not matter to us whether it is 7,000 Yehud or 2,000 Yehud and 4,000 Yisraelites and a smattering of Goyim. Doesn't matter. That is not part of our responsibility. Our responsibility is to get the message out about this so that everyone who is open-minded and receptive and is interested in knowing God and is willing to do the work, invest the time to come to know what he is offering and what he expects in return, that so long as we've done our utmost to maximize the opportunity for people to be among that harvest, we've completed our mission. That's all that we can do. We're not going to compel anybody to make this choice. We can simply convey the information and let people choose as they will. Why anybody would choose not Yahweh, I have no idea. He's wonderful. He's fun. He's brilliant. He's uplifting. He's generous. He's fair. He's just everything you would ever want in a father and more. But nonetheless, none of the religious will even say his name. None of the secular even know who he is. And there's a very small number of Jews that are interested in it. And that, now, that number is going to grow as part of this trauma bonding, which means that that whole discussion we had last week about the relationship between these two remarkable men, Jonathan and David, means a lot. That is where Israel is headed. And hopefully they trauma bond together. Well, that's my answer. Does anybody want to add something to that?
No. No, that's good.
You can tell I'm rather passionate about this stuff. I like it. I feel a tremendous desire to learn and a passion to share. And in fact, Dee, I sent you today something I wrote this morning about the whole premise of what we're doing and why we're doing it. Maybe sometime during this program we'll come to a question where that's pertinent to share. But one of the goals here is to no longer be needed. Now, this is the best job in the world, best job I've ever had. I would do this job if no one was listening but my two dogs and my wife, not necessarily in that order, but my wife and my two dogs. I would do it if I was the only person listening. It's fun.
No.
But the
it is.
But somewhere along the way, Yahweh made it more responsible, more responsibility, and a little less fun, more serious, because this is exceedingly important to him. And so he revealed through his prophets 3,000 years ago what we were going to be doing. And when God says something like that, you'd have to be the biggest nincompoop in the world to let him down. Do you want to be the first false prophecy that God makes is because you were stupid? No. So what I'm hoping to do is, with the time we have remaining, to do the best job possible of sharing knowledge and then helping people with insights and their thought process through commentary, like shows like this, so that you can go from not knowing to knowing and then make the transition from knowing to understanding. Because once you understand, I'm irrelevant to you. You are on your own. We can have a fun discussion, but you are self-sufficient in your relationship with Yahweh, and you're self-sufficient in terms of bringing others into the covenant family.
I think
that's the way I ended the book on Ezekiel. I said, okay, the story's over. We made it through the end of the book. And so there's now some questions that linger, and the last line of what is an 1,100-page analysis of Ezekiel is, will there be anybody celebrating Sukkah who will turn to you and say, thank you, based upon what you did, I'm here today. And so that really is the goal here, is if you could be a good enough teacher and more people understand that there are many of us out there helping Yisrael and Yehuda reconcile the relationship with Yahweh. So the ultimate goal is to no longer be needed, to work yourself out of a job. And then it goes back to just being fun and none of the responsibility anymore. So that is what we are about. That's why I don't have any short answers.
Well, I'm glad. I like to appreciate the
thought process. Yeah, me too.
Okay, I have another one.
All right, this is by Lee. He He says, I have often tried to understand what people mean when they say they are spiritual, used mostly by the so-called enlightened religious as a pedestal to stand over the common people. I understand that our souls are born into a spiritual state of being through our spiritual mother. But isn't that after the death of the physical body?
Okay. There are different kinds of spirits. That is one of the reasons why in the book of Ezekiel, like I just wrote the back cover for the book, the second volume of it, and sent it to Jackie today, and said that just because Ezekiel is a false prophet, just because it is Satan's autobiography and his playbook, is no excuse for turning and saying that I don't need to know what it says. Because it is the best way to understand how Satan has manipulated the world, especially through religion and politics, over the past 6,000 years. And one of the things you learn is that Satan does not act alone. He is a spiritual being, likely one of the cherubim that were guarding the walls around the garden. And we don't know what number of Moloch, the cherubim, would be part of the spiritual implements of Yahweh. He has garnered with him and that support him. The third of the heavenly host that fell thing is in Revelation, and so you can't rely on it. But clearly, Hasatan is a spiritual being, and he has influence. So it is possible to be spiritual and not be godly. Now, Yahweh is spirit. The set-apart spirit is our spiritual mother and the most important aspect of spirituality, if you will, in our life. And she helps to protect, to purify, to make look appear perfect, to enlighten the covenant's children. So she plays a tremendous role, just as our Heavenly Father does in our lives when we become part of the covenant. So we do gain, even in this life, a spiritual component with God. So you can have a spiritual component like the religious, where you're associating with Hasatan's spirit, or in prior to death, you can have a spiritual relationship with Yahweh and actually have the presence of Yahweh's spirit in you and on you. We know this for certain because of what Yahweh said with Job when he was 8 years old. Yahweh said that he placed his ruach upon Job, and the ruach never left him. So the spirit is there for our benefit. Now, the spirit made Job look perfect in Yahweh's eyes, but he was hardly perfect. So it is, you know, we all have a nephesh soul. That's the reservoir of our unique character, persona, our aptitudes, our appetites, our just our personal nature. It's how we observe the world around us and how we respond to it. So we have a nephesh soul, and that soul can benefit from the set-apart spirit, and we become a kind of a blended being here on earth as part of Yahweh's family. And then when with the passing of our physical bodies, which are a tremendous liability, with the passage of those bodies as the covenant family transition from this 3D world into the seven-dimensional realm of Yahweh, then it is a marriage strictly of our souls, which is our consciousness, and spirit, and we become entirely spiritual beings. Now, the advantage of a spiritual being is that it's infinitely more powerful and capable, but it's also forever. It's a spiritual being is like light, endures through all time, and also can maneuver in all seven dimensions, of which now we can only maneuver in three. So it is tremendously beneficial, but also as Einstein explained with relativity, even in the four-dimensional mm-hmm. realm, he understood energy is and matter are the same things. So our physical bodies and energy are comprised of the same thing. It's just that energy is a great deal more than is matter. You have to multiply matter times the square of the speed of light to amount to the same amount of energy. So matter is a diminished part of energy. So this transition from being a material being with a soul to being a spiritual being with a soul is enormously empowering and enriching and enabling for us. So complete answer is you can be spiritual here on Earth and be associated with Hasatan. You right. can be spiritual here on Earth and be part of the covenant family. And it's still a blend of your soul and those spirits, and on Earth still our physical body is a limitation and liability. And then as we transition beyond this 3D realm, those who have associated with Satan spiritually will go to the penitentiary that's akin to a black hole and Sheol, everlasting darkness. And those who are enveloped in Yahweh's spirit, as was Dod, for example, that's how he was anointed, we transition into eternity with Yahweh.
Very well said. All right.
I suppose you have another one.
I do. This is by Jim. And okay. we touched on this a little bit last week. He mentioned, since World War III will bring on a worldwide conflagration, how do I determine how to protect myself and my family? Should I expect Yahweh to speak to me? Am I supposed to figure it out myself? I can see it coming, but how should I respond? It is very unclear to me.
Okay. Yeah, we did talk about this last week. First of all, we are going to have a worldwide collapse. I was particularly concerned not as the world as a whole, but how the world responds to and pummels Israel, and he's going to protect Israel from utter demise, although majority of Jews are going to die in this process.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a much higher percentage of Goyim that die, and obviously more Goyim because they outnumber Jews by several hundred to one. So, yes, we are going to have a worldwide calamity, and Israel will be invaded likely by Muslims because the text of Yeshaya 17 speaks of them flooding into Israel after the nation is thinned at the waist and after the fall of Damascus.
And I
think that, by the way, just speaking of Damascus, because that is the opening of Isaiah 17, Yeshaya 17, it speaks of Damascus, which is the longest continuously existing city in the world. And it talks about it becoming a twisted heap of ruins. And, you know, when we translated that 3 or 4 years ago, the obvious was, do you look at Aleppo and all the other cities around it, and you look at what the Islamic infighting has done, and you would say, well, those cities are a twisted heap of ruins. There's also the possibility that in addition to the Islamic terrorism, that an earthquake is going to pummel them, because if you look at what happened in southern Turkey and Syria here with their inferior building codes, although, you know, clearly a 7.9 earthquake followed by a 7.5 is going to wreak havoc no matter where you are. The inferior building codes and the poor quality of cement and the lack of rebar made a tremendous difference there, and that became a twisted rubble pile. And so it is also possible that earthquakes will bring them down. But when all that occurs, we will have an Islamic war against Israel. Talks about a flooding in of Muslims. They flood in at such a rate that only Yahweh can stop them. There aren't enough bullets and the IDF to bring that to a halt. So we will have that. And we're clearly going to have economic collapse. And what I've said is that there is no answer in terms of how you protect yourself. I want to be very careful. I am not a doomsday prepper. I don't want to be cast in that role. And I'm not your financial advisor. I do not want to be cast in that role. All I would say is there are some prudent things that one should do. We have now a home garden. My wife, it's her pride and joy. We grow a lot of our own produce now. We have better part of a year's supply of food here. We don't want to overdo either because then you become a target. We are self-sufficient in terms of our energy needs. We generate our own power. We produce our own water. We have our own sewage system. We are pretty much independent, and we live in a very sparsely populated place. I would suggest if you live in a city and you have the ability to get out of the city where I think the chaos is going to be worse, and you can get out a bit into the suburbs, that would be safer for you and your family. I think safer is to have some skills, have some tools, and have some seeds and have those kinds of things. As in terms of investments, we've certainly learned that cryptocurrency is mostly an illusion, that the primary investment tool to stave off destruction of countries has been gold, but countries manipulate gold, and they will confiscate gold, and so it's not a perfect solution by any means, and your dollars are going to become meaningless before very long. So I'm not going to give you any financial advice. I would be as prepared as you can be. But what I said last week is the single best advice that I can give you is embrace Yahweh, become part of the covenant. Then it doesn't matter. Then the longer you're here, the more good you can do, the more people you can encourage to be part of the covenant and live forever. So every day that you're here, no matter how rough it is, the better. And yep. And then after that, you have eternity in a marvelous universe. So that's the answer to that question. And in terms of can you figure it out for yourself, boy, you know, I think there's like 30 books on the bookshelf now.
That's what I was going to say.
read them.
Yep.
Everything that you need to know is there. And it's all presented very clearly. I am verbose, but Yahweh's verbose. Yeah. If Yahweh can tell you something in 100 words or 10 words, he's going to choose to tell you in 100 words because you're just not going to be able to absorb it, process it, put it into your long-term memory, and have a working understanding of it unless somebody kind of helps you paints the picture, if you will. And explains how it fits into the big picture. And that's why Yahweh likes people like Dod, like Moshe. They didn't give you a Cliff Notes version. There's no outline. It's a lot of information, and you need to be able to process it and have the want to. It's not difficult. It's really just the want to. Okay. Yeah. Have any others?
All right, he wants to know when Yahweh speaks to you, does he speak in Hebrew or English?
We are all born with where our brains think in a language. I think in English. I'm sure that I'm not the most articulate person in English, and so you might question that. But nonetheless, that is my birth language. I think in English. He conveys in thoughts, so our communications are in English. The more I translate, the more I spend time in his words. And, you know, my working vocabulary in Hebrew is probably 5,000 words or more. And I'm pretty skilled. In fact, I'm more skilled in Hebrew grammar than I am in English grammar at this point. And so even though I still think in English, my thought process is very significantly guided by the nature of the Hebrew language. Like verbs that exist throughout time, as opposed to past and present and future tenses. Verbs that all are have stems that establish relationships of various kinds between the subject and the object over the action of the verb. Volitional moods. So, and then the various just the concepts of like Kodesh, what it means to be set apart. And therefore special, and therefore unpopular, uncommon. So there are just marvelous aspects of Hebrew. So it has shaped my thinking, but in this particular job, the prophecy was that I was going to communicate in a language other than Hebrew from a place a long way from Israel. And that's the best not only I can do, but it is what the world needs the most.
Right. All right. He also asks, if prophecy is the proof that Yahweh is God and his prophets are to be listened to, does that mean that Satan does not know the future? If so, how do Christians get revelation about things that are about to happen?
Well, Christians don't. I mean, if you read...
they don't?
You read all of their books. And I used to... write about you know, like Hagee had his blood moons and had this whole series of books on what was going to happen. The founder of the Seventh Day Adventists were Jehovah's Witnesses, one of the two, had predicted that God was going to return, Jesus was going to return at the turn of the a century ago. And no, they're just wrong on everything. They don't know what's going to happen. Is the answer. Now, as for Hasatan, the adversary, he can read. He's not very articulate, not very smart, but he can read. So anything that was predicted by Yahweh in the Torah and prophets, he knows. And so it isn't difficult for him to figure out that the great showdown between he and Yah, his last hurrah, is going to be in the days leading up to Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, which he knows, just as we do, is going to occur at sundown in Jerusalem, 22 p.m. on October 2nd, 2033. He knows that's what he's pointing to. He knows it's the day of reconciliation. So he can read. So he knows that it's going to be a time of Jacob's troubles between now and then, and he knows that everything's going to transpire in Jerusalem. So he can read what the prophets say. I think he has a reasonable understanding of what they say. But he is not himself capable of coming up with an independent prophecy. So if you read something in a religious text that isn't derived from Yahweh's Torah and prophets, then it is something that a religious person has imagined, and it has no value. It's like in Islam, Muhammad is called a prophet, except in the Quran, where it's acknowledged that he was not a prophet, and he never got. There's not a single prophecy that Muhammad that came true. And many that did not come true. So there is no prophet Muhammad. Clearly, Paul, who created the Christian religion, not a prophet. So lots of false ones. My wife told me that somebody in our community asked about Jonah, and was Jonah a prophet? And you know, you can read the book of Jonah in about 3 minutes, 4 minutes. I mean, it's a pretty short read. So what would you be looking for to know? Sometimes, this is an example, I want to put myself out of business here. I'm trying to earn a retirement. So I want you to know how I would go about doing it, because my process, Moshe gave us two different times over the test to determine whether or not somebody was speaking for God and is a true prophet inspired by God or a false prophet. First thing is, do they claim to be a prophet? Jonah doesn't.
Right.
So he wouldn't qualify under that basis. Second is the presentation of current and past events accurate? In Jonah's case, no.
Right.
You read that story, it is just, oh God, it's just nuts. I mean, here is a guy, Yahweh says, I want you to do something. He says, oh no, no, I'm going to outsmart you, God. I'm going to get in a boat and I'm going to row away from you. That'll show you. Oh, come on. You're dealing with God and you're going to run away from, you either tell him, no, I don't want to do it, like Moshe did, but you don't go run away and hide. Moshe just said, I'm not up to the task, plus I don't want to go back there. And, you know, Moshe was the only choice, and God stuck with it and continued to work with it until Moshe said, okay, I'll go do it. But this kind of thing that God asks and you say no and then you run away and he pursues you, no. God will introduce himself to you if you have disassociated from religion. But if you say, nope, I want nothing to do with you, hasta luego, man, you're done. Don't do that. That's what he did. And then, you know, he tells this whole story. If you throw me in the water, so the one person that God wanted, allegedly, to communicate with, if you sacrifice him and throw him in the water, everything will be cool. Huh? Exactly the opposite of the way it's supposed to work. And then the solution is he's swallowed by a whale. I'm sorry. It is possible, by the way, to be swallowed by a whale. And it is possible to survive being swallowed by a whale. We actually even have film of it now.
Yeah.
You know, if you're,
3 weeks later.
Yeah, you're a diver, and a whale is feeding on fish. They can swallow you. I mean, up to you're getting their mouth. They're not going to get down their gullet, and you can survive for a short period of time. You are not going to survive in the belly of the whale for more than about 5 minutes. However, so that story is not credible. If the story is not credible, it's not true. And if God wanted to tell a story that about his protection, then he's going to protect that person in a way that is consistent with his nature. And sea monsters swallowing people is not consistent with his nature. In fact, one of the terms that he uses for Hasatan is Loitan. Leviathan is how it's presented in Bibles, but it's Loi, as in the Levites, Loi. Tan, as Tan is one of the Hebrew words for snake, venomous, toxic snake. So it's a toxicity of being united, which is what Loi means. So that's a sea monster. Sea because of the goyim. And monstrous and serpentine, as in Hasatan. And so, no, God's not using a sea monster to do this. And then he has his conniption fits. Every time God calls him, he's throwing sand in God's face and stamping his feet and childish and say, no, I won't do that. And he has kind of like Job. What right do you have to be so angry? And then there's this tree, a tree that's planted, and he curses the tree, and God gets angry from the curse. Is there a prophecy in it? No, not one. Is there a historical story that can be validated? No. Is there things that are inconsistent with God's nature? Yes. Does he claim to be a prophet?
That's what I thought when I read it.
So, no, I don't even think it has any value. Now, if you're a Christian, you've got a real problem because your Jesus quoted it and said, you know, the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the land, just like Jonah was in the belly of the whale. So if you're a Christian, you're in trouble. It's got to be true. Unfortunately for you, it's not.
Paul's based on it as well.
Yeah. All right. We have another question.
Yes, he wants to know if you're familiar with the Nazarene Acts, which
recounts. I'm going to answer this question. Then we probably only should take a minimum. Quick, I'm too long-winded to have too many questions from one person. I don't think it's fair to the others that have asked questions. But go ahead and ask that question again. I'll ask I'll answer that one, and then we'll move on to somebody else.
Okay, this is asked twice. They just want to know if the Nazarene Acts could possibly be Paul, Simon Magus be Paul, and it recounts a debate taking place between Peter and Simon Magus, and they want to know if that could be Paul.
Easy answer, no. It's
no, that's what I was going to say.
It is a complete and utter waste of time. Written long, long after the time, and there are two Clementines that could be either one of the two. We don't even know which one. It appears to be a homily by a Christian, made up story, religious text. No credibility.
Hundreds of years after Paul.
Oh God, no credibility whatsoever. Just no. Listen,
just,
the Christian New Testament is
incredible.
You've
got all the Torah.
And they
want
to talk about books that are written by numbskulls that are trying to advance the myth of the Christian New Testament, that write their own stuff about it. No, you're going further and further down a dark rabbit hole. No.
Yep.
No. Easy answer, no.
All right. I'm going to skip down a little bit.
Okay.
Kelly asks if Yahweh is outside of time, or since Yahweh is outside of time and able to see past, present, and future simultaneously, when Yah and Dod return in 33 CE, will Yah have already experienced the event and the 1,000 years thereafter? And
no.
Is that like our ability to experience? Okay.
No. No. Of course not.
Okay.
Just because you are in a position to know the future doesn't mean you're going to choose to know it. Just because Yahweh could know all things doesn't mean that he does or wants to. Can you imagine being God and knowing what the fake Astinians are plotting to do? I mean, it would be unbelievable. Can you imagine being God and being there when the Haredim are having one of their religious services? Or, you know, you got Mormons doing their thing? No. I mean, God chooses not to know about this stuff. And as it relates to his children, he is capable of knowing what's important for him to know and allowing the rest to play out and enjoying the way that it plays out. If God knew everything we were going to do before we did it, then it would be
what's
no enjoyment whatsoever for him in having a relationship.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in my case, God couldn't find a Yehud or a Yisraelite to awaken his people. He's going to come home, and he's going to prevail, and there's going to be a wonderful reconciliation, family reunion. And so he said, I'm going to find a Goyim that's going to communicate to my people so that they're there. And in terms of then how we were going to go about fleshing his story out and translating his testimony and learn and share along the way, I think a lot of it Yahweh is experiencing along with us. And I'm certain that as we move into eternity, he's going to choose not to look forward in time and enjoy the experience as it grows. So yeah, just because he can, it doesn't mean that he will. And in most cases, he won't.
Yeah.
And in most cases, he hasn't.
Right. Okay. Joe asks, how important is Yahweh's name to someone who claims to be in the covenant family but uses the name Yahweh rather than his correct pronunciation? But they still observe the feast, the Shabbat. How would Yahweh see that person in terms of his family?
I think on a 1 to 10 scale, that's a 1. The reason for that is that the key aspect here is that God has a name. Now, you can do what I did, and I spent a week doing it, where I looked at every Hebrew word in the entire lexicon of the Torah and prophets that had a yod, a hey, and a wa in it, and I charted them all out in terms of how those letters were pronounced. And then I re-examined it again from words and names which were definitive. And I came to the conclusion that it was a 99.999% likelihood that Yahweh's name is pronounced Yahweh. Not everybody's going to do that. No, when Yahweh chose to communicate his name to us and reveal his name to us, he chose Moshe to do it, and Moshe, by his own admission, had a speech impediment of some sort. We don't know what it is. So if God chose a person whose diction was not spectacular to convey his name to us, he obviously isn't concerned that you might mispronounce it. And so the answer to that question is, we have absolute proof in the choice of Moshe to reveal Yahweh's name to us that if you mispronounce it, God's not going to be upset. If you don't use it, if you negate it, if you call him the Lord, if you call him Jesus, if you call him Allah, you're in deep trouble. But if you mispronounce Yahweh and you call him Yahweh, I think he'd be annoyed, but not enough that that would preclude entry into his covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that there was a question that you skipped over because I saw the questions right before the show from a week ago. And Stephen, who does us a lot of good, had some questions. And I don't want to shortchange Stephen. So would you mind
going? Oh, I've been
going,
saving him
going,
for last
going, Yeah, I think you skipped Stephen. So let's not skip Stephen.
Yeah.
He does a lot of good work on behalf of Yahweh's message.
Yes, he does. He had some pretty interesting ones, such as, have you ever seen a UFO in your lifetime or while flying a plane or at any other time, or have you had a supernatural encounter with a spirit or been in a haunted house?
No. No, and the reason that it's not only the answer is just simply no. If you just take the words unidentified flying objects, there's lots of things in the air that are unidentifiable, and that that does not mean that it's any kind of hocus pocus or an alien. It's just we can't discern exactly what it is. I saw about 2 weeks ago the sky light up in the evening towards the west. Never seen anything like it. Had no idea what it could possibly be. My wife told me there was a SpaceX rocket from Florida. That's a long way away from where I'm here, but it's so bright that it illuminated the western sky with a pattern that modeled it. So it was an unidentified flying object for me that became known. I am 99% convinced that there is life on other planets. The best we can tell, there's somewhere between 400 and 500 billion galaxies, and these galaxies can have up to 400 billion stars. Probably the average is 200 billion stars, and most stars likely have planetary systems around them. And so, if you're looking at the odds of 400 billion galaxies over a 100 billion light year span, averaging 200 billion stars, each with 5 to 10 planets around them, the likelihood of having another Earth kind of scenario, I think, is really quite high. But more than that, Yahweh loves life. He is, he thinks life is wonderful. And I think when he created DNA as a three-dimensional language to be able to create a wide variety of interesting life forms, that became a blueprint to do it elsewhere. So I would strongly suspect that there are life forms elsewhere, and that I think that'll be a hugely entertaining part of us transitioning, such that we can spiritually travel through the universe. It's what he did with Adam and the Garden of Eden. He introduced all of these life to him, let him come up with the names for them, and they spent significant amounts of time sharing life. So I think it's highly likely that it exists. Now, the nature of physics is that no object, no material object of any size, can be accelerated to the speed of light. It takes infinite energy to get it there, and it would expand the object to the size of the universe. So you can't get anywhere near the speed of light. And the distances are enormous, where, you know, the one side to the other of the known universe, and who knows how big it really is 100 billion light years. That means that 100 billion years, if you could travel the speed of light, you could get from here to there. No. The universe isn't even that old, not by a long shot. So it's just not possible for a physical being, therefore life form, to get from one place to another. And the idea of warp speed and that sort of thing is silliness. This idea of a wormhole and black holes and all that sort of thing, when you get to that kind of stuff and concentrated mass or energy, it's pure depth. It sucks you in and you never get out. So if you could find a place where time is warped, it's only warped in the presence of great energy or great mass, it would become an eternal prism. And so, no, it's just isn't possible. No one has ever seen an alien coming by here. We can't get from here to there in our present form. We'll have to become spiritual beings for that to occur.
Okay. He also touched on something that you had mentioned last week. He asked again about clarification regarding if a covenant member decided not to engage in matzah after they had followed all the steps of Pesach, especially considering ex-covenant members.
We talked about that last week. What happens if you were to engage in Pesach, you're not circumcised as a male, or you don't accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, or you celebrate Pesach without incorporating matzah, it's the worst of all possible circumstances, because Pesach, properly celebrated, opens the doorway to eternal life. But without matzah, you retain all of the stigma of religion. And God's not going to tolerate any aspect of religion around him in eternity. So you would be eternal and yet eternally separated from God. And that place is called Sheol. So Pesach without matzah is a very bad thing. Matter of fact, that's the nature of Judaism, by the way. Matzah is not celebrated. There is no chag matzah in Judaism. And they get that from the book of Ezekiel. In the book of Ezekiel, there's only one of Yahweh's seven moed that continues. It is Pesach. It is horribly corrupted. I mean, it bears no resemblance to Yahweh's presentation of Pesach. And matzah is just an ingredient. So there is no chag matzah. Without chag matzah, Satan's plan for those who would observe it would cause everybody that follows his advice to be like him and to spend eternity in Sheol.
Right.
Okay, next.
Okay. Hopefully that clarified some things for him. And Cheryl asks, she spoke to Kirk about this the other day. She has two daughters, and she wants to know how a covenant person would get married. Do you need a state marriage license?
Most of this is going to be recorded but not broadcast live, and we may even get cut off because Blog Talk Radio likes to do that to me. I love this topic because there is no marriage ceremony in the Torah. That whole, you know, till death do us part and forsaking all others and all that sort of, that's Christian mumbo jumbo. It does not exist in the Torah and prophets. Most of the people that Yahweh had relationships with and accomplished things with had multiple wives. Dode is the exemplar of the person Yahweh loved the most, who he calls right. He had 10 concubines and 8 wives. And you know, even Yahud, the firstborn of the covenant, he's out having negotiating sex with whom he thinks is a temple prostitute, turns out to be his son's wife and gets her pregnant. So, I mean, there's just a lot of stuff going on. And it's very clear that there is no marriage ceremony in the Torah. You choose somebody you want to be with, they want to be with you, and you live together and form a family, support one another. You are married from the perspective of Yahweh. If you choose you don't want to be with that person anymore because they make you sad, or you just don't choose to be with them for any number of reasons, the Torah solution is real simple. Write them a letter. Explain what the reasons are. Everybody goes their separate ways. So the Torah does not have a mandate on monogamy. It does not have a mandate on a ceremony. It has a very simple instruction on divorce, which is write a letter, go your separate ways. When the statements recorded in stone speak of you shall not consistently commit adultery, it is in a spiritual context. It's a religious context. Don't be unfaithful with the relationship with Yahweh, which is a theme that runs throughout the prophets. So the answer is God is not a cosmic killjoy. There are very few instructions on sexuality, and they run in the issue of incest is bad, rape is bad, sex with minors, pedophilia is bad, sex with animals, bestiality is counterproductive. Don't do those things. But God has very little to say about having multiple sexual partners someone being married to more than one person, or even having additional sexual relations outside of what one would consider marriage. So it is a religious ploy to restrict
control.
It's a control mechanism, and I think it does tremendous harm. In Islam, women have no rights. They're controlled and abused by men. And Orthodox Judaism, women have no rights. They're controlled and manipulated by men. Many of the fundamentalist sects of Christianity, women have no rights. They're controlled and manipulated by men. And the men that are at the heads of these religious organizations, rabbis, priests, for example, imams, are very often sexual predators. They have a much higher percentage than society as a whole. So it creates a control mechanism that has been exceedingly counterproductive to humanity in general and women in particular. So when you get into that, I think that was part of those who decided they don't like me anymore because I shared with you what the prophets have to say and the writings have to say about the relationship between Dod and Jonathan, because they've been conditioned that, no, it can't be. A man can't be bisexual. Most people don't have a problem with a woman being bisexual, so we're a little hypocritical in that regard. And they don't see the positive of that and the teaching that goes along with it and the implications for our time. And they're so conditioned by religion's influence on our culture that they will throw it all away just because it's uncomfortable for them. I mean, I had this problem when I was dealing with Ezekiel. There are two chapters in Ezekiel that one presents Satan essentially raping Chawa. And him having his way, and it's exceedingly explicit sexually. And then there's one that follows it that's far worse, where he is a pimp, and Israeli women, Jewish women, are his prostitutes, and he speaks graphically of the abuse of them. And when I wrote that, and I translated it based upon the actual text, and it's, you know, it's exceedingly graphic, and, you know, you get a lot of pushback. You say, you know, you can't say that stuff in polite society, but that's what it says. You know, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to soften it so that Ezekiel sounds better? Or do we just lay it out and say, this is what it is? And if you can't engage in a conversation about human sexuality and the abuses of it, maybe that's your upbringing, and that maybe you need to shed some of that anxiety and be prepared to have an honest discussion, because how in the world are you going to preclude this dehumanizing and demonizing of women, and particularly Jewish women, in the book of Ezekiel, if you aren't going to talk about it?
Right.
So, it's a subject that I think is important for us to discuss, because almost all of the "you better not have fun with that, that is a no-no" sexuality is a man-made control mechanism, and that God invented it, sexual relations between men and women that are mutually chosen and not abusive should be fun.
Right.
It should be a wonderful way of expressing affection for one another, and it ought to be playful and fun. And so I understand there's a lot of people that because of this culture just say they can't handle that, but that's nonetheless what the words say. Anytime there is activity that is sexually different than the mores of our society, you do not find God saying, no, I'm angry at you. It's off to hell with you because had more than one wife or you had concubines, whatever it might be. No, it just doesn't exist.
Right.
In the when somebody is raped, you know, in the case of what happened with, you know, Benjamin and the rape and the dismemberment of the woman. Oh man, yeah, he's all over that. Yeah, that's really bad. When Dode made the horrible decision to send Uriah, his very loyal, good man, off into a battle that he thought he would lose, so that he could take his wife, Bathsheba. Yeah, it was all over that. Said no, that was a really rotten, terrible thing to do. To be ashamed of yourself. But it had nothing to do with going from seven wives to eight wives. It had nothing to do with the additional concubines. It had all to do with, no, what you do. That was a conniving and underhanded and disrespectful, and it's not the way you should treat someone. So it's God's thoughts on it anyway. I'm sure we didn't get to the end of all of the questions. We should probably go back to our regular format, and we'll return to this, and maybe we can do once a month or something. We'll collect the more interesting questions, and you know, feel free to share them on social media with Dee, who reviews all of that. And good questions come. I had one that came to me today, I think, is when I first saw it, and a gentleman whose son is not circumcised, and his wife vehement against it, and he himself is circumcised. He wants to be part of the covenant. He wants to attend Pesach, but he was concerned that the fact that his son was not circumcised on the eighth day, that he would be precluded. And, you know, the answer is no. He would not. God cannot hold you accountable for what you did before
what
you knew
it. You can control.
And, you can control your own circumcision, but if you're married and the mother of that child says absolutely not, You can't go and perform the act on that child. And second of all, this particular individual made a very wise choice, a decision. He said, you know, I think I'm better off staying involved in my son's life and teaching him about Yahweh so that he chooses to embrace the covenant than I am if I simply walk away. I happen to agree with him. I think he, in fact, everything he wrote, this individual, I think was wise and informed, and look forward to him becoming part of the covenant. And, you know, he may or may not succeed with his wife and with his son. You know, we all have various degrees of success and failures with those around us, because Yahweh's not very popular. He should be, but he isn't. So there are far more people who are going to choose not Yah than will choose Yah. Any other questions before we leave? Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just saying Moshe had that problem. Remember, his wife, they had a big argument about circumcision, and she didn't circumcise the child.
Yeah.
They didn't throw the parts at him. So, I mean, here's your bloody thing, whatever. But, So it's not unprecedented. I mean, you're not in a situation that's not been done before. So, it's tough. Yeah, anyway.
Yes, and clearly Moshe was in a different position because, Moshe is the great liberator, the great prophet, the marvelous exemplar. Moshe is not the average fellow.
No.
You know, as much as I love Dod and Yahweh loves Dod, I think Moshe is the most extraordinary man who ever lived.
Sure.
So when you know that he's dealing with something, then it's tough. You know, it's like that whole episode in the waters of Meribah where Moshe essentially gave up. He says, you know, these people are way too contentious. I just can't handle
it
anymore.
Get me out of
here. And I want to get out of here. And Yahweh says, listen, I get it. I'll give you a personal, private tour of the Promised Land. I'm going to show you every aspect of it. So this idea that Moshe was prohibited from going in is nonsense. Yahweh flew him around, got to see the whole thing. And of course, he'll get to live in it forever. So that's also Moshe is an exceptional man. And yes, did he have his moments where he wasn't perfect? Yeah. But
sure.
I want to tell you, at the end of the book of Ezekiel, it is so disgusting. And you recognize that this book has traumatized, dehumanized, demonized Jews and put them in a position for mass extermination. There is nothing that was ever written that has been as hostile to or as oppressive towards Jews as the book of Ezekiel. And you realize that it's only there because someone who was Jewish wrote it. Their Hebrew wasn't very good, but it was good enough to write it. And it was all religious Jews who maintained copies of it rather than throwing it away. And it was religious Jews who said it belongs among the prophets, which is where the Christians found it, and they loved it.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating to have your life's mission to reach out to and awaken Jews so that they embrace Yahweh when you know they have done this to themselves. It's hard.
Yep.
And so part of the story is that God's people don't make it easy. And if you want to see a wonderful example of that, read about the waters of Meribah. You know, it's interesting, too, that when Satan's redefining the borders of Israel, the southern border is based upon the waters at Meribah. And the reason for that has nothing to do with the border, not going into Arabia. It has all to do with every time he has the opportunity to raise a point that is embarrassing to Yahweh and to his people, he does. You know, the other part of that southern border was Tamar. And Tamar, there's two of them. One is Dod's daughter that was raped by his eldest son, who was then murdered by Absalom, who turned traitor. I mean, it's an exceedingly embarrassing moment in the life of Yisrael and in Dod. wants to remind him of that. Ya'ud, Judah, the firstborn of Jacob, the woman that he introduced to his firstborn son, that became the wife of his firstborn son, who then pretended to be a prostitute that he negotiated sex with and impregnated after his son had died. Guess what her name was? No, Satan's not kidding around, man. He finds something that's embarrassing to Ya'ud, to Israel, to Yahweh. He's all over that. And so it's...
And therefore, he can obviously read.
Yeah. And you even look at Gog. That name wasn't chosen out of oblivion. It's only mentioned once. And where it is mentioned, he is the offspring of Reuben. What did Reuben do? Well, Reuben was disinherited because he went in the wrong bed, man. He had, just to be mean about it, he had sex with Bilhah, who was the mother of two of his brothers. No, it's just bad stuff. So he's trying to antagonize them. You read about he's got this layer cake of rearranging territory for the 12 tribes, and actually does it for 13 tribes. He gives Lowy land. And what you find is that it's just all listed like you're checking out lentils at the grocery store, like, okay, this and this and this and this, until you get to Yehuda. And then he carves out spaces out of Yehuda for his prince, who is the incarnation of Satan during the last days, and for the Lowy, and for his complex, which is like Auschwitz on steroids. And the habitable portion of the territory that he is offering to Yehuda is 370 square miles. The amount of land that he carves out for his prince, for the Lowy, for the city, and for his mega complex from Yehuda is 370 square miles. His goal is to bury the city of Jerusalem so it no longer exists, and to deprive Yehuda, the beloved of Yahweh, of everything. Fortunately, Ezekiel's temple will never see the light of day.
Mm.
But Rabbi should have been able to figure that out. They should have known why this is wrong. I know the Haredim, they don't teach the sciences. They don't teach them geometry, but it's pretty simple geometry. And they don't teach them math, but it's pretty simple math. And maybe they can't figure it out because they just don't have the skills anymore. But they can read Yada Yawa. That, actually, the Babylonian Babel series, because it's all spelled out for them there. All right. Well,
another
thank
gift.
You. I don't know if everybody else has liked these Q&A shows. You can
they
tell
have.
That I like. You can tell
I
that
do.
I like
I mean,
them.
It's,
yeah,
it's like
I
drinking
like
wine
a
with
lot.
You at your table. We can talk about all that kind of stuff. It's cool.
Yeah, the reason I like them a lot is with Q&A, you have the opportunity to not only teach, but teach on subjects that are obviously interesting to family members and those who are considering becoming part of the family. That's rewarding.
Yeah.
But it also gives you the opportunity to be extemporaneous. And that's the difference between not knowing and knowing and then going the extra step to understanding. If you've taken the time to know what Yahweh says and then understand his approach, when you're given a question, you may not know the specific answer to that question, but you're going to be able to share information that will help everyone answer the important aspect of that question. It was just like our review of what the text says about Jonathan and David. I can't tell you how far they went sexually. I mean, obviously they were fawning all over each other and they were kissing one another. We know that. We don't know anything beyond that. But what we know is how important important that relationship was and how extraordinary those men were and the effect of trauma bonding, we know and we can learn tremendous things from that. So that's the advantage of the Q&A opportunity, is it gives you the opportunity to be extemporaneous, and I just think it adds credibility.
Another dimension, yeah, absolutely.
Not everybody does. We had some people that found the door and kicked some sand in our way on their way out, and you know that's okay. You know we don't have a clubhouse. No clubhouse here.
We don't.
No annual dues. Yeah. No donations accepted. We don't count followers. There's no attaboys or attagirls. The ultimate thing in the end is how I ended the book on Ezekiel. If you're going to be counted among those who are celebrating Sukkah, with our Heavenly Father upon his return, will there be anyone there who will look to you and to say, what you did made a difference and is one of the reasons that I'm here? And that really should be our motivations. Are we helping others come to know Yahweh and be part of his covenant family? And if we are, then that's the ultimate reward in this life. All right, my friends. I think we've worn it out for today. It's been fun to be with you, and to as I say, we're going to return to our normal format next week, and then do a question and answer periodically after that. Unless we get the response after this show, please don't do that to us again. Then we'll go back to the
I highly doubt it.
All right. Good to have you back, Kirk.
Right,
glad that there's
thank
actually
you. I'm glad
power now in California.
Gin Airs. Invest in Gin Airs.
Yes. Yeah. Blessings to you all. Good night.
Good night, y'all.
Happy Shabbat.
Shalom, shalom, y'all. Absolutely.